Okay, it is Tuesday, August 4th, 2026, and once all the videos are posted, you will. If anybody watches them, they were real. 2 weeks ago, I was in near Dublin, and then a week ago, I was in Wexford County, and now I'm back in Alameda County, Berkeley, California. So it's been a little bit of a journey. We're going to start as usual with a 20-minute sit. And then I'll talk a bit. Very nice to be back home, of course, and as always, just to see this community and just look at the names and faces on the screen, the people who've I feel like we've been together with. I've been together with many of you for years now, and then than anyone new, you are more than welcome. This is not an elitist group. In fact, I'll add that we something I don't mention very often is that we do have a list. I know Monica usually puts a link to it. We have a list where people can put in their contact information, and if you need support or want to connect with some other people in a wholesome way, obviously, from here, you are invited to do that.
I put it in. I usually put it in after the Dharma talk.
No hurry. I just was thinking about it, and I thought I would bring it up because if I don't mention it when I think of it, I'll forget it in five minutes. But the idea that if maybe if you're new to practice or new to recovery and you'd like to connect with somebody who has some experience in this realm, and people give little descriptions of their experience and things on that, it's like a Google sheet of some kind. So all right, let's begin with some meditation, and I'll give some guidance as I usually do, and then we'll have some quiet time. So just settling in to your sitting posture, whether sitting or standing, lying down or walking. And if you are sitting and not in a moving vehicle, you might close your eyes, although you can just lower your gaze if you're more comfortable having your eyes open. You don't really need to look at the screen. I will keep an eye on the screen for any late arrivals. Other than that, just to really turn inward. To connect with the body. And this is the starting point of practice. Really, an area of practice that can carry us is always a foundational element, ongoing foundational element is awareness of the body in general, and then, of course, the breath in particular. But it's helpful to take a little time to just sort of settle the body, see how you're holding it, how your posture is like. If there's any sensations that are drawing your attention, and then trying to bring kind of an attitude of ease. Just being settled, nowhere to go, nothing to do. It's one of the striking aspects of this practice is that when we just stop moving and sit still for a moment, that we can immediately experience our body and ourselves in a different way. Certainly, most of the time, we aren't probably paying attention to all the sensations in the body. With such a seemingly simple thing, mindfulness of the body. Yet it's like moving into a different realm in a sense, a realm of stillness, or that's connected to stillness, a realm of aliveness, of the life of the body. We spend so much time in our heads, either generating thoughts or inputting information or stimulations. It's almost a radical act to stop that for even a few minutes. Just be aware of being alive. And starting to feel the breath, the essence of our lives, that vital component, almost the defining quality of life, is breath. When we think of birth, there's that first breath that says, I am alive. So we cry out. And when we think of death, there's that last breath that says, this is finished. And each breath in between is necessary, needed, must be there. Yet, like so much else in our lives, we just take it for granted most of the time. Of course, I'm breathing. Not going to spend all my time thinking about that. I've got important things to think about, to accomplish. So much of the time we ignore life itself. Instead, we're living in a kind of virtual reality of the mind, chasing after sense stimulation, pleasure, avoiding discomfort, solving, analyzing, forming opinions, and all along the breath continues. When we hear the instructions to pay attention to the breath, that's how to meditate, we might think, okay, that's easy. And we quickly discover that the habits of mind, the busyness of mind takes us away over and over. How to deal with those movements of mind becomes the challenge of practice. Turns out that the mind doesn't really respond to the kind of efforts we take in other activities. We can't force it to behave or wrestle it into quietness. Soon enough, we realize we're going to have to take a different approach if we're going to be comfortable in this experience. Here, the Buddha says, practice without halting, but and without straining. We don't strain to stop thoughts. I try to let go, but that doesn't mean halting, that doesn't mean passivity. It's a subtle reorientation of awareness. Learning to observe with openness, with acceptance. Continue to come back to the breath. To watch where the mind goes. To see what the mind does, how it reacts when it becomes aware that the mind is wandering, mind watching mind. And now, what seemed like the simplest of tasks is revealed as something so subtle. It can barely be described. It can only be experienced, explored, investigated. As we start to see this subtlety, the mind can step in again and try to figure out this other level. And then we need more letting go. We return to the simplicity of breathing in, breathing out. All right. Managed to not fall asleep. That's progress. Yeah, so again, nice to see people, nice to just be sitting with you. And yeah, if I can indulge in a little bit of, as I normally do, somehow my teaching comes out of my experience in my life, and this has been a delightful couple of weeks traveling, I'm discovering at an old age that, oh, I could actually enjoy traveling because I used to really not like to do that. So, and traveling alone, there's a different effect that you wind up meeting people when you're with someone else. It's not as much meeting people. So of course, I had gotten this connection to, and as a, if you don't, I'll give you the if I can do the brief background on this. Sometime over the winter, my wife said, "I'm going to go to Finland for this swim in the river in Lapland, but before that, I want to go to Copenhagen." And I was like, "We last summer we went to Stockholm." Like, I'm going to go to Ireland and play golf. So that's how this trip came about. And I have one person I consider a pretty good friend in Dublin who works in treatment and has arranged for me to teach in Dublin before. And I visited with him a few times. And so I just emailed him and said, "Do you know anybody who plays golf?" And I probably told you guys this story already. But anyway, he said, "Oh yeah, my friend Tony, he's the captain of the St. Margaret's Golf Club." And Tony turned out to be a very generous, very, just welcoming, kind of a ringleader of a group of sober golfers. And so Tony also works in treatment, and yeah, has about, I think about 10 or 12 sober golfers at his club, and they all play together and go to different clubs. And so it sort of was like joining a gang. Like, it was really kind of like, what? And they, some of them sort of were familiar with my work or whatever. I think Tony probably let people know, like, "Oh, this guy's done this." And so there was maybe a little bit of extra juice I got from people. It was very, very friendly, and a lot of hugs, and something like not like anything I've experienced in a long time. And but as I looked at my schedule, and I had another trip for another friend to go another part of Ireland down to Wexford, I realized, well, I've got like 4 or 5 days in there, and if I'm going to be in Ireland, I really should go visit Áirgean Amaru. And if you don't know who he is, he's an English monk in the Thai forest tradition, was first, trained under Ajahn Chah, but he met Ajahn Chah towards the end of Ajahn Chah's teaching career, because Ajahn Chah had a stroke around 1981, I think, and then he lived another 10 years, but he wasn't able to teach and speak. So he was mostly Ajahn Sumedho's student. Anyway, these are people that, if you've been around this world, you sort of know their names. If not, you might learn about them. They all have lots of writings and teachings out there. But Ajahn Amaro is a, if he hadn't become a monk, I was just thinking about this, he would have been a poet and a novelist. Actually gave me, he has a series of Buddhist historical novels, and I'm reading one of them that he gave me when I was there. He also gave me a book of his poetry. So, but I met him, I got to know him about 30 years ago when he came to Northern California to be the abbot of turned out the co-abbot of the Abhayagiri Monastery, and that was 1996, and I had just come back from finished graduate school in Irvine, and was really in had really gotten back deeply into Buddhism. I was about 11 years sober then, and soon after that I went into a. And so he was showing up at Spirit Rock a lot and Berkeley, and so would see his teaching a lot. And then I was invited into a teacher training in 1997 at Spirit Rock, the Community Dharma Leader Training. And he was one of the teachers who was, one of the teachers of that training. And so I got to know him further in that setting. then when my daughter turned 5, which was about 2003, I started to take her on the Spirit Rock family retreats, and Ajahn Amaro turned out to be one of the teachers on the family retreat. So I sort of have these encounters, a lot of connection with him in less than formal ways, especially the family retreats. And he would actually sing Bob Dylan songs around the fire the last night of the retreat, where we were eating s'mores and things. And turned out he had all these Bob Dylan lyrics on his iPhone. So not sure if that's in the Buddhist tradition, but he was a monk long enough to get away with it. So, I always felt a lot of fondness with him. And then at that same time, when I was writing One Breath at a Time, I wanted to know that at li that that the book would be viewed favorably in a more traditional Buddhist context. So I asked him to read the manuscript. So he read the manuscript of One Breath at a Time before it was published, and gave me the thumbs up on it, as well as some great notes. So it's been a long relationship. So, here I am in Dublin, and I think, it's an hour to fly to London, and the monastery where he's now the abbot at Amaravati is a half-hour train ride outside of London. So I set that up, and I went over there last Thursday, and arrived at around a little before 2 o'clock, and I had emailed him, and he'd said, "Just come knock on my door." And so I knocked on his door at 2 o'clock, and he lives in a kuti, what's called a kuti. And I've always envisioned a kuti as being sort of like a grass hut, in the forest in Thailand. Well, the abbot's kuti at Amaravati is not a grass hut. I came in, and he was making a espresso out of his espresso machine in his kuti. And then we went and sat in his sitting room, which had French doors that opened out onto a patio that was, flagstones, and then a big, rather large goldfish pond, and with wisteria and all kinds of vines and things hanging over it. It was a beautiful, beautiful spot, sort of a magical spot. So we sat and talked for a couple hours, and everything from the kind of the personal to he's turning 70 in September. I was asking him what his plans were. His sisters take him on birthday trips. And of course he knows Graham, having been on the family retreat with her, so catch up around that. But then, of course, got into some Dharma teachings, and I brought up kind of the theme that I've talked about a lot with you guys, is like the five aggregates of body, feeling, perception, mental, volitional formations, and consciousness. And how, when I'm working with that, the way I view, and I've talked about this around, particularly around emotions, is that when I'm just on the feeling level, that if I just sit with that, that kind of keeps me from getting lost in my thoughts and my story about my feelings. But that as soon as I give a name to it, which is the perception level, as I understood it, that then the story starts to build. And he clarified something, at least from his viewpoint, and I think it's a helpful one. So he doesn't see perception as quite the same way I do, which is to say, in other words, that I'm going to have to think about what he said, because he knows more than I do, to say the least. But he views it more as just sort of like that first knowing of what something is without it turning into a story. But he then added a couple of little pieces to this, saying that what happens is you have the feeling, and then there's the sort of identification of it, the sort of knowing what it is. And then there's vitakka, which is thinking about it, which isn't necessarily a problem. But what that can trigger is papancha, which is proliferation. And here's where the problems start with our minds. And this papancha is such a great word, and I'll put it in the chat for you to see it. Just for you to know that C, the letter C in Pali, is often pronounced as CH. And so papancha is translated as proliferation, and I think that's a really good translation of the word, and that it kind of captures what happens to our minds. And I think this is a helpful thing to, in terms of reflecting on and understanding and sort of holding our meditative experience, to separate these two things, vitaka, which I'll put that in there too. I think I have the spelling of it. Might not have the H, but anyway, might be vitaka. Somebody could look that up for me. It's Pali for thinking, basically, but and it's used. It shows up as having sort of different meanings in different contexts. But generally, this idea that you can be meditating, and there's kind of thoughts happening, and it's not really a problem, because you're not really spinning out on it. It's just kind of noise in your mind, and you would like it to get quieter. But it's not really a problem, right? You can notice it and come back and let go. But then papancha is when you, to me, there's like, I'm thinking of those fly catcher things that you hang down that stick to, right? The flies stick to them. It's like your mind gets stuck like a fly on the papancha, and then you're just stuck, and you're spinning out. Now I'm like, thinking about myself or my fears or my resentments, and I'm just I have concerns about the term rabbit hole, but I'll put that aside. Papancha, the mind just starts to proliferate, and you're really lost. And in that state, then you're getting triggered, right? Because the papancha, the proliferation is partly happening because you're triggered, because you're having a feeling that you're not liking, that seems problematic. And then the papancha is triggering more feelings, and so you have this whole explosion, right, that happens in the mind. And here you are trying to meditate. You know what I mean? Like, this is one of the reasons why people give up meditating when they first learn it. They can't control their papancha. Would you please control your papancha? It's really, but that, I was thought meditating was going to be peaceful. Instead, I'm like spinning out more, and which is why we like to get on, our phones, because it keeps us from the phone does the papancha for us, and then we can just like, not have to be in our own heads. We're just like, Twitter is essentially, electronic papancha, right? So this, I think, can be helpful for us, first of all, to not worry so much when there's vitaka happening, when there's just thinking happening that's not papancha, right? That's not like, it's just like, yeah, it's a little like I would like it to be quieter, but it's not really a problem. And if I just sit with this for a while, it'll probably settle a bit. And I'm not going off on long journeys. But then the papancha is where we need other strategies, right? And this is where, come back to Jack Kornfield in A Path with Heart, when he talks about the top 10 list, or I can't think of the phrase, but the persistent problems or something like that. And that's persistent problems are kind of the ones that show up as papancha. And so now we have to really become more skillful and adept in our strategies of meditating. What do I do when I get lost in that space? Because I don't want to suggest that, oh, you can learn how to meditate so you'll never have papancha again. That's not really what we're talking about here. That isn't reality, I don't think, for most people. But rather, that when I find myself there, what do I do? How do I just suppress it? Do I kind of force it? So, I mean, there are various strategies, but the one that I use is that I come back, obviously, to the breath, but more essentially to the feeling. And as many of you know, I basically teach the same thing over and over, sometimes starting somewhere different, but winding up at the same place. Just I come back to, like, what does that feel like? Because that papancha, in some ways, I can say the papancha is triggered by a feeling, but in some ways, the papancha is trying to solve the feeling. I'm trying to think my way out of an uncomfortable feeling. And when I realized, like, I know, again, cliche, but there is no way out except through, which can, in this case, just means being with, breathing with. And here I just think is that so much of the essence of dukkha, of the suffering that we have in our lives, is our unwillingness or inability or not knowing how to just sit with the difficult and the unpleasant. And that when we can do that, and we can just go, oh, well, this is just unpleasant. I just don't like it. But if we don't have the fight with it, if we just, again, breathe with it, feel that, allow it to be there on this very kind of primal organ, like state, this before it turns into a story, before it turns into papancha. What is it when it's just a feeling? And it's just energy. It's just something that we can feel and breathe with. Then it stops being a problem. And I have to say, I mean, I teach what I try to teach what I do and what I know. And this has had a profound effect. And I feel like even the fact that I could be comfortable taking a trip like I just took. Like, it was interesting. So when I went to the UK from Dublin, I had to get up early in the morning, relatively early for me, like 6 or something, and get a taxi to the airport. And then in the Dublin airport, you're walking forever in airports, right? Especially over there. I mean, I think Heathrow is like the size of a medium-sized city. It's so enormous. But you're walking through the airport, and then it turns out you have to get onto a shuttle bus to go out to the plane. And then you walked up onto the plane. There was no jetway. And then you fly. And then you land, and then I got to find my way to the tube, and I had figured out what stops, and I'm like, okay, counting the stops and checking, the thing, like making sure I'm going to get off the tube. And then I get to the train station, the Euston train station, and get a ticket. And then I got the ticket just in time to get onto the train just as it was leaving. And then it goes to Berkhamsted. And then there you come out and you get a cab to the monastery. And now you're at the monastery. Ah, right. But in the course of that, all those different vehicles and stops, it's unpleasant. And my aversive mind in the past would have been like, oh, like, first of all, like, oh, I'm not even going to bother. That's too hard. But if I did it, I would have been like, oh, this is so, oh, God, like, oh, this is terrible. And I've really been practicing. You'd be very proud of me. I've really been practicing, like, oh. And it was like, just, in fact, I noticed like there were different levels of unpleasantness in the trip. And some of them, like to me, being in the airport in the shuttle bus, that was sort of unpleasant. Being in the plane's not that bad. But then coming through Heathrow, that's pretty unpleasant. The tube was like kind of unpleasant, but then I saw a kid with a Cal sweatshirt on, so then I chatted him and his girlfriend up a little bit. And that was kind of pleasant. And then when I got on the train to at Euston Station, I was like, oh, this is really pleasant. It was air conditioned and it was plenty of room. Yeah, the tube was really, really crowded. So it was like, I really was like tracking pleasant and unpleasant and neutral on the way. And then getting there, well, driving out from Berkhamsted, and I'm sure some of you have driven around England or Ireland, the road is like barely wide enough for one car. And the taxi drivers are like driving as if like this impossible that someone would come around that blind corner. So don't worry, we're not going to die in a head-on collision. I'm like, okay, I'm going to die in a head-on collision, but that's okay, And, but so that was unpleasant. I mean, unnerving. And then I'm there. It's like, oh, this is really pleasant. Like this monastery is very pleasant. So I gotta say, I mean, it really works, Like to not like go beyond just the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, to be able to stay there. And I really feel like my practice has been growing. And it's sort of embarrassing. I mean, I've been practicing for 45 years and been sober for 41 years, and I've been teaching for 30 years. And I'm like, I'm starting to feel like I kind of am getting this thing. It's starting to work. Mean, it's always worked. But it's really, really sweet. So I'll tell you one other little story, just a practice story. So when I was with Ajahnamurugo, I said, it turns out that it was like the very beginning of the what's called the Vasa, the rains retreat. So in India, this would be the beginning of the rainy season, not the rainy season in England. So they sort of do 2 3 month retreats. The one where they really practice is in the winter when it's really the rainy season. But now sort of an officially, so they were going to do a week long like scheduled retreat. And there's a bunch of lay people staying at the monastery, several of whom are, thinking about ordaining. And some of them, I got to have lunch with some of them. And in any case, Ajahnamurugo said, well, tomorrow morning at 8:30, I'll be giving a short reflection for the morning sit. So I was like, great. And because I couldn't stay at the monastery because I didn't have the, you have to have a sleeping bag or bring your own linens. So I stayed at a place that Rosemary and I stayed last time we were there 4 years ago in Berkhamsted. And I was like, okay, I want to get out early to the monastery and I'll sit for a while before the reflection. And that'll be great because then when I'm listening to reflection, I'll be settled. And so I get into the meditation hall at like 10 to 8, like perfect, it'll be like 40 minutes sit. And then I figure he'll give like a short reflection and then ring a bell and we'll have walking meditation. So I'm sitting for like 40 minutes and I hear, I mean, it might have peaked, to see him coming in, but the monks all come in and there's nuns and monks. And it's incredible meditation hall. I have pictures of it. I could put up somehow. I have to email them to myself, maybe next week. Anyway, so Ajahnamurugo talks for a while and it's lovely. It's kind of a guided meditation reflection. And, now I'm kind of settling and it's a good sit. And then there's no bell. He does not ring the bell. So I'm like, okay. That's great. I'm sitting, it's been like an hour. I'm thinking, oh, he'll probably ring the bell at 9 o'clock and that'll be good. And then it's like, and I must have looked at my watch or something. I don't remember looking at it, but I may have glanced. Anyway, I'm kind of said, okay, no, there's no bell. Now it's been an hour and 10 minutes. I'm sitting and I've kind of gone through like the many stages of meditation. You sit down, you kind of like get settled and then, a little bit in the mind, like kind of busy mind, and then kind of settling. And then with the reflection, it's like, oh, this is nice. And then after the reflection, I'm like starting to fall asleep, right? So I'm like, I have my like nodding off period, but then like I come through that. And then I'm like, sometime in the hour, 10 minutes, hour, 20 minutes, I'm like, now my butt's really hurting. So now I'm going to lean forward. I'm going to breathe and feel my butt, but I'm like leaning forward and then just like, okay, sitting, sitting. Finally, the bell rings at 9:30. I'm like, Okay, that was 1 hour and 40 minutes. That was not my ordinary period of meditation, but that last 20 minutes was like a glow, you know, that kind of, oh, this is why people sit for longer periods of time, because like the energy that kind of comes through once you've worked through all five hindrances and the papancha and various different experiences. Turns out there's going to be some nice energies on the other side. So it was very funny because it was like, you know, thinking that you're gonna like, I'll manage this, right? Like I'll sit for this period of time, and then like, no, you're not getting to do that. Like, and of course, you know, I'm not gonna like stand up in the middle of the sitting in this, you know, glorious meditation hall with all the monks and nuns and like leave because my butt hurts or something. Like, no, I'm gonna keep sitting here, you know, and kind of got the payoff. It kind of made me think, I might have to start, you know, doing, you know, 2 hour sits every morning, which I usually limit myself to 45 minutes. But, you know, it does really point to, you know, one of the things about practice that there's no replacement for time. And I gotta say, this is another one of the things that connects directly to recovery. There's just no replacement for time in recovery. You can't speed up recovery, and you can't speed up meditation. And that's why people like take ibogaine and or you know that ayahuasca to speed those things up. Like, I'm gonna do that ketamine, and I'm just gonna be recovered. You know, I'm just gonna get a spiritual awakening, take a nice trip, and I'm done. All the work is done. You know, I don't want to have to do all that meditating for hours on end and falling asleep and having papancha and having, you know, painful knees and painful butt. No, I don't need all that. Like, there's more efficient ways. This is 2026. You know, there's an app for that, right? But in my experience, there really isn't. So there's no replacement for time. So I will leave it at that. And thank you for you. I hope that something I said today is more than just entertaining. Thank you for your kind attention. And we have a few minutes if people want to share, chime in. And thank you, Monica, for putting in all the info in the chat. So if you're interested you know, signing up for our list, just joining that list, having your information in there. Then of course you can always offer Donna to me as well. And yeah, thanks. Right, and all the things that are coming up. Maybe you could put in the Monica, the Buddhist Recovery Network conference, October 2nd to the 4th in Oakland. So I hope that people will come for that. Anyway, anybody wanted to share or say anything or ask a question? I see John has got his virtual hand up.
So I just wanted to comment real quickly that your description of that hour and a half meditation was great. You know, it was very brief and you just sort of went through each of the phases. And I thought, well, that was very very informative. I mean, you know, the longest I've sat is at your retreat, you know, for
Yeah,
45 minutes, and
right.
that was tough. So it was great to hear that description though. Thank you.
Well, right. And thank you, John. And yeah, I guess the takeaway for me is it keep coming back. You know, it gets better. Like, and that there, you know, there are these places we can get to that are delightful. I mean, that's not the point of meditation. It's, you know, so don't ask me what the point is. That's another Dharma talk, but that's not the end goal. But just to know that it's not all just a struggle, you know, that and you know, fundamentally it's about letting go of that struggle. And when just the same thing I was talking about my travels and like just if things are unpleasant, you know, not fighting with it, not turning into a problem. And it's the same thing with practice, but meditation gives us an opportunity because we're not doing anything to actually be more deeply aware of everything that's happening, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And so those unpleasant things, we learn to bring the strength of our mindfulness to the experience itself, to feel it. And there is a shift. And this is kind of like the physics idea that, when something is observed, it changes. When you observe the unpleasant, it can turn into pleasant, or at least into neutral, or just become less unpleasant. And that, of course, has to do with the what we call acceptance or surrender to it, the not fighting with it. Because it turns out, just again, these themes repeat over and over, the two darts. It turns out that the unpleasant thing, when you take away the resistance to it, that second dart, it's much less of a problem. And I mean, this is just it's like I keep saying it over and over, and I keep working with it over and over. When I was at the airport yesterday, it took a long time for the baggage to come through. And that lately I've been finding baggage getting through very quickly, but probably because the flight landed early. And my wife and I are communicating. She left something on her plane, and then it took a long time for her to get the thing off the plane. But it turned out that that almost coincided when my luggage came out. But I had to wait a little while, and I was tired. I had just flown for 10 hours and waited for an hour and a half for my luggage. And it was like, and I hadn't seen my wife in 2 weeks. And I was like, why the hell did she leave something on the plane? And what, I could just get on a taxi and go home right now. And then I was like, okay, this is like not at all what you want to do. Like, what are you doing? Like, you've been waiting for 10 minutes for her after a 10-hour flight, and you're gonna like have a fight with her now? What are you doing? It was like, oh, look at that. There I go again, And I was like, no, we're not gonna do that, Kevin. We're gonna be really happy to see her, and we're gonna have a really nice taxi ride home. And indeed we did, and it was lovely, and it was great. But it was less like, I'm an aversive person, and when you're tired and you're cranky and it's like you're ready to go, let's go. Like, what? So it's the same thing. But in practice, we get to really, because you're sitting there meditating, you're like, I don't have to do this. I don't have to sit here any longer. I can stand up anytime I want to. Like, this is unpleasant, And then when you stop and go, oh, wait, I heard that it's actually useful to just practice with this unpleasant. Well, let me see what happens. And then it turns into something else. You're like, oh, that's interesting. I consider it like, it's like Vipassana Tantra. So Tantra is the tr changing, it's working with energies and transforming energy. So classically, it's like transforming sexual energy into spiritual energy, but it can be all kinds of energy. And so, whatever you're experiencing meditation, if you can breathe with it and not fight with it, you can transform it. So it becomes a kind of tantric practice. I know the Tibetans probably wouldn't approve of me saying that, but let them come on my Zoom and fight with me if they want to. All right, you guys. I see there's some comments or something. Oh, well, thank you, Jeff, for commenting on perception and Buddhist gang fights. I'm gonna have to read that. What does it say? Mindful observation changes perception of the object, right? The interaction between the sense doors and the consciousness is a purpose of practicing mindfulness. Okay. Not sure why that means Buddhist gang fights, but I will take your word for it. If there are no more questions or comments, I'll just say that I mentioned this recently, just to offer really some loving kindness that to the places and the people and the parts of the earth that are experiencing warfare right now, and just really feeling, I mean, I just am really trying to make this a daily practice to send peace, and to pray for peace, really, and as well for our planet, which is also in great distress. And spending time in Ireland and England, which are experiencing dry and hot weather, it's like a reminder of, like, we really need to care for this planet. So may it be so. May there be peace, and may the planet be healed. Nothing else from me this week, and I will be back here next Tuesday, and then next Tuesday night I'll be in Berkeley for those who want to be live. So, blessings. Thank you all.
Thank you, Kevin. It was fun
Thanks,
today.
Kevin.
Great
Yeah,
talk.
thanks. Thanks,
Thank you.
Steve. Thanks,
Hey,
Monica.
Kevin.
Yeah, Mike.